On January 16th, 1919, the ratification of the 18th Amendment was completed, with the full effect to take place on January 17th of 1920. Now, this amendment may hit home with many football fans because it made illegal the manufacturing, sale, and transportation of alcohol. Curiously enough, though, this may have been the very thing that helped keep the Rochester Jeffersons afloat in the NFL, because the hero of this story, the Mr. Everything for the Jeffs, Leo Lyons, was able to make some stone-cold cash himself to pay for the salaries of his All-American football team with the money he earned as a bootlegger.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott!
This time, as we step off the DeLorean, the date is October 13th, 1918. We're on a moving train because we are on our way back to Rochester, New York. We just got done watching the Detroit Heralds beat up on our Rochester Jeffersons, but that's not why this is important. The one reason why this is important is because one of our buddies is riding solo in a train car back in the way back because he's down with the sickness, the influenza pandemic that's sweeping the globe and the nation. That's where we left off this interview, the last one, with John Steffenhagen, the preeminent source of Rochester Jefferson history, and we will pick back up this episode to learn how the influenza pandemic almost wiped out the Rochester Jeffersons and the rest of this interview. So if you have not listened to the first part of the interview, then you need to take your finger, you need to mash that little pause button, then flip a script back to the first part because you need to listen to the first portion of this interview so you can hear the crazy course of events, the timeline that has led us up to where we are now. Almost getting into the NFL for the Rochester Jeffersons, this tiny little town. You can get there, actually, by heading to the dedicated page on my site at thefootballhistorydude.com/John Steffenhagen. That's John, J-O-H-N, Steffenhagen, S-T-E-F-F-E-N-H-A-G-E-N. Again, John Steffenhagen. But let's not me wait you anymore. Let's get back into this interview with John Steffenhagen. Yeah, I didn't even realize that there was such a severe epidemic in 1918 around the wartime. I mean, was it considered something that was biological terrorism, or was it just because it happened?
No, actually, it was the, you've heard of the plague. It was actually the plague from medieval times had come back because people hadn't been inoculated for it, been taking shots for it. So it started up and it would just spread. And it actually was so extreme during the wartime that I get the numbers right here, an estimated 50 million people worldwide died.
Wow.
From it. I mean, and there were 675,000 cases in the U.S.
Did it run rampant throughout, even in Europe and everything? Where did it affect the war at all and the efforts?
Probably not sure on all that, but it was helped along by, you know, your body being weak. I'm sure a lot of soldiers, you know, from the battle and that were weak, and I'm sure they were taken by the influenza epidemic as well. But yeah, it was a serious thing. And actually here in Rochester and probably across the rest of the country, churches were closed, schools were closed, any public places, restaurants were all closed up. Like anything where you could come in contact with it, they try to lessen it. So yeah, it was pretty major.
How long did it go on for?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, because I just wonder, I mean, I don't know if it really happened to any, but if there were any restaurants or other local businesses that were on the verge of closing down anyways, this might have just devastated them, and then they were shut down.
I would think so, yeah. I mean, yeah, it definitely had effect on businesses, you know, especially, yeah. I mean, stores, I believe they closed down, you know, department stores and things as well. Because then everybody was, of course, panicked about it, too. So it was, people weren't even coming out of their houses. It was pretty serious.
Yeah, it's something that hopefully we don't have to deal with like that in the future. But I know that there's always the chances around the corner. And speaking of chances always around the corner, there's still getting close to that phase three, step three for Leo. Where was he at after 1918 and dealing with the war and the influenza? Where do we go next?
Okay, so we're now at 1919, year before the NFL. Rochester is still playing teams locally. They're dominating them. They're still beating up teams from the rest of the state. They get some pullback from the Buffalo Prospects, who had become one of the best teams in Buffalo. At that time, they pretty much were kind of doing what Leo was doing, taking the best players and putting them all on one team. So in 1919, the Buffalo Prospects would win the state championship against the Rochester Jeffersons. They played two games for the championship. The first one ended in a 0-0 tie. And I believe the second one was a 7-0 victory for Buffalo. So they're still, you know, state champions or playing for the state championship every year. That year as well, in 1919, a side note, George Halas, who was playing football out west, actually contacts Leo for the first time because they would become lifelong friends later on. But at this time, George Halas is a young man. He wants to know if Leo has a spot on the team for him. Leo turns him down for it because at that time, Halas, he wasn't the best player, you know, in the country. And Leo had a bunch of players that he was happy with the cohesiveness of the team and turned them down. And then George Halas went on to sign with the New York Yankee baseball team that year. And then George Halas gets hurt and can no longer play baseball. And then he goes back to Chicago and, you know, is with the Bears. But it was kind of a weird story of George Halas moving around before the NFL, and I never knew he played for the New York Yankees.
Yeah, and I had no idea that. Just think about that. It kind of reminiscent of Michael Jordan being cut from his high school basketball team to go on and be one of the best all time.
Yeah, right? It's like you just never know. So that was a little side bit. So, all right, so now it's time. He's got his step three. He's ready to complete it. 1920 rolls around. Leo gets a phone call from Jim Thorpe. They're going to be starting a league. He wants Leo to come out and represent the Rochester Jeffersons. They were the only team from New York to be invited. And September 17th, 1920, 14 men representing 10 teams meet in Ralph Hay, who is the manager of the Canton Bulldogs. He had a car dealership, a Hupmobile car dealership, and they met in the showroom to form the league, and Leo was there.
So Leo was there, and could it be said that it was traced back to, in a way, all because he reached out and he started trash-talking to Jim Thorpe?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think so. Yeah, because later on, Jim Thorpe and Leo would become good friends, and at that time, Leo didn't know the extent of like how known it was to Jim Thorpe, you know, how the Jeffersons were doing. But later on, Thorpe would tell him, you know, it was because of your trash talking that it impressed me that, you know, here's this young kid challenging us. It's like no one in the country did it. It's like you turned heads. So Leo did exactly what he wanted to do, is make himself known, you know, and he did it. And yeah, he was there in the showroom with Jim Thorpe and George Halas to form the league, and he's considered one of the co-founders of the NFL.
Yeah, that's a movie in its own right. A person at such a young age with such drive and being, I mean, of course, you could cut jump scene to all the different things, being a doctor, being setting up this field, but then challenging the Mr. Olympia, the greatest athlete of the 20th century, and all the, I mean, how do you make that stuff up?
Right, I know. And what was also great was that those teams out west in the Ohio League and the Canton Bulldogs, these teams were all backed by businesses or rich businessmen And here you have Leo. I mean, even the teams in Buffalo he was playing against, or Syracuse, they also were backed up by businesses or had financial backing. And here you got Leo working two full-time jobs and the only guy doing everything. So that in its own right is pretty remarkable for Leo to be a co-founder of the league. And that's why I think he sets apart from the other ones, because he was definitely, you know, one of a kind.
Yeah, I mean, if you look up the definition of bootstrap of NFL, if you combine those two words, then I guess Leo's picture's got to be there because he was a definition of it.
Right. I mean, so yeah, so there, that day they set the ground rules for the league, and it was originally called the APFA, which confuses a lot of people. It actually confused me when I was researching all this. In 1920, the NFL considers September 17th, 1920, as the birth of the NFL. However, it wasn't called the NFL. It was called the APFA, the American Professional Football Association. And then 2 years later, they would change the name officially to the NFL. But I've had a lot of people tell me in the past, like, oh yeah, the Jeffersons, they were one of those, they were an APFA team. They weren't an NFL team. It's like, well, no, they were, but they were an NFL team. So that's a big misconception. Here in Rochester, anyway, a lot of people didn't actually realize the Roger Jeffersons were an original NFL team.
Well, being an original NFL team, what was their first game? When did it play, and who did they play against?
So, yeah, that first season starts. Again, now there's still no set schedule. Teams are playing teams that are in the league and teams that are not in the league. I mean, literally, an NFL league team, they could play a high school team. I mean, there was no set standards or set rules. They just played whoever. So it was whoever you could book. Leo, right away, didn't realize what a disadvantage he was in at that time, because no one wanted to play them, Rochester, because they knew nobody was going to come see them, because either they didn't know them, or if they came to Rochester, there probably wasn't a lot of support in Rochester at the time for money-wise. So all the teams would try to book against the Canton Bulldogs, you know, some of the big teams, Chicago Staleys, who became the Chicago Bears. So that season, the Jeffersons ended up playing just a couple of NFL league teams, and the rest were just against Buffalo or even just the Rochester local teams to fill out the season. So at the end of the 1920 season, he realizes, okay, things have got to change. I can't compete with these NFL teams now out west, because they are now in the process of paying players bigger money. They're getting the bigger players. So he knows he's not going to be able to compete in the league with the team he has. So this is when he starts to recruit college players from around the country. There is no NFL draft. It's just a manager will go after a player at a college if he's well known and pay him money to play on the team.
Well, how did he then, as a smaller team, you know, not backed by a financial juggernaut of a business or anything like that, how did he kind of sway these college players into playing for him then?
Well, at the very beginning, he had, I guess, saved up money and worked maybe even two or three jobs, because at the start of the 1921 season, NFL historians, Bob Carroll, who was one of the top historians, and other historians agree that the 1921 Roger Jefferson, they had like 8 or 9 college All-Americans on his team. And so I was curious. I'm like, how is Leo, the same thing you just said, how is Leo affording all these All-American players on a team by himself? So I had come to learn through his journal after he had died and started really looking through all the pages that this is the time that Prohibition was taking place in America, the outlawing of alcohol. And I come to find out that Leo was a famous bootlegger in Rochester, and thus making lots of money.
Ah, so he was He was pushing the liquor to be able to get his team to be able to actually afford the All-Americans out there.
Yep. And it was ironic because his dad was an alcoholic. And Leo,
yeah.
And Leo didn't drink either. He wasn't a drinker. So it was kind of ironic that that would be help him financially along. And at the same time, he's still going to area businesses at this time, even especially, you know, he's saying, look, professional football, we have it now. Other cities are going wild, Chicago, Green Bay. It's like, here's our chance. We got a professional team. We need support now. And he was still laughed at in the papers. This isn't going to last. It's going to only last for a few years. And again, he's still got to fight a battle with everybody to get it going. So it was tough.
Man, yeah, just from the beginning through the end, it just sounds like if he would have just had some support, then he could have put his focus into other areas instead of always having to try to, you know, fight by the chinny chin chin for just money.
It was always a battle. I mean, Bob Carroll, who was an NFL historian, had written the famous article, Rochester could have been another Green Bay. I mean, if with the right support, just even Kodak would have backed them up, that Rochester very easily could have been in the Green Bay Packers, or they would have been the Rochester Jeffersons, would have been an NFL team. So, 1921, he's got all these All-Americans. Now, he thinks, okay, now I can compete. Just when he thinks he's got it good, Rochester itself revolts against Leo because they are mad at him that he got rid of the local kids and brought in college players. So Rochester wouldn't come out for the game. They would literally pack the high school game and boycott his team. It was like, are you kidding me? He got this far. And now his city is turned against him because he's picking up college players.
So were they more successful, though, in the standings, even though they didn't have the fans there to support the revenue?
The first 2 years in the league, they were good. They had a winning season. But, again, the fan base wasn't good, and he could only hold on to the players maybe 5-6 games, and then they would leave because they were paid per game almost always at this time. So he was able to, again, you don't know how much money you're going to have every week. So he's paying the players weekly or per game. But then, you know, during the season, the money would start running out. There goes your All-American. He's taken off for another team. There was no loyalty or anything for any team. So this would be the demise eventually. And then 1922 rolls around, 1923 rolls around. Again, picking up players, but they can't stay long because you start to run out of money. And then slowly it just starts going downhill, but he still doesn't quit. He still keeps doing what he can. The team would last for 6 seasons, doing the same thing, but slowly going downhill. But every year he would hope that, you know, a business, somebody would come along and help him, but it never came.
It almost sounds like it was the inverse effect of what the Patriots have nowadays. It sounds like he was more of like a farm club for the rest of the league. He would find the players and get them in the league, and then they would pluck them away.
Yep. Yep. That's about what happened. And again, by like 1924, now the bootleg is becoming more popular, so he isn't making as much money because there's too many people doing it.
Mm.
And now he resorts to doing something which a lot of teams did at that time. Would college players were forbidden to play in the National Football League as they are now. Like, you can't just go pick up a college player. So Syracuse is only an hour away. Syracuse at the time, Syracuse University, is a very good college football team nationally. So Leo now goes to Syracuse, shows up in the locker room of the players, and, you know, hands them cash and says, look, come tomorrow, play for my team. We'll use an alias. We'll give you another name. Play for the team. And then that's what he was doing for a while. He ended up having 24 Syracuse University players on his team through the next few years, which is pretty funny. He actually got caught by the commissioner of the NFL, Joe Carr, would contact Leo and say, "You're not supposed to be doing this, you know, stop." But the commissioner didn't do anything to him because he was still hoping, even him was hoping that, you know, Leo would succeed, that somehow, some way it would work. But of course that didn't work. But he tried.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds like the same situation, because the Packers were doing the same thing and they got thrown out of the league at the beginning for, I guess it was only a few months because they let him back in, but I'm surprised they didn't do anything to him.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, the other teams had been either suspended or fined, and I guess Leo was a likable guy. So, you know, Joe, at that time, he's like, you know, don't say anything to anybody else. I'm not going to suspend you or fine you, but just stop doing it. But he got caught several times doing it. They let him keep going because they felt sorry for him. They're like, come on. It's like, he's trying. And he actually got shot at one time on this campus because, the star quarterback had won the game against, I don't remember, it was a big team, and the player had forgotten his cleats in the locker room. So Leo and the star quarterback had to climb through a window, break in to get his sneaks. And I guess there was a security guy called Big Mike, and he ends up chasing him out of the building and then firing shots at him on the Syracuse campus. I guess it made the big news headlines in Syracuse. And a Rochester football manager and star quarterback shot at him. It was like, what?
Wow, yeah. And they still didn't end up slapping him down with a fine or a suspension or anything like that. That's crazy.
Right? So, yeah. So then, you know, his dream, he can see it coming, but he's still not going to give up yet. Or everybody else probably on the planet would have given up. The last season rolls around. He still doesn't want to give up, even though he knows it's not going to work. He plays all the games on the road. He doesn't even bother having home games anymore because nobody comes to the games. And then his last-ditch effort would be trying to sign Rhett Grange, who would end up eventually signing with the Chicago Bears. But Leo brought a $5,000 check and was going to offer Rhett Grange $5,000 a game, which back in 1925 was a lot of money. Questionable where he got the money from. Nobody knows. He did put his house up. He actually mortgaged his, or had put up his house for a loan to get Rhett Grange.
Wow.
You talk about somebody who was dedicated. I mean, literally, yeah, he almost lost his marriage and his house, I know, at the end there, to sign Rhett Grange.
Just imagine if he would have actually been successful in signing Rhett Grange. I wonder if we would be talking about the current Rochester Jeffersons fighting this Sunday, you know, against whoever, the Buffalo Bills.
Right. Well, that's what he felt like. You know, Rhett Grange was such a popular draw. I mean, bringing him to Rochester, you never know. I mean, but that was as much as he could muster. And actually, I had found out later on that Tim Mara, the owner of the Giants, was also at that hotel room with Leo in the hallway, and they were also going to make him an offer. And he had already committed to Chicago for, I think it was like $100,000. I mean, something insane.
Yeah, that's how, I guess you could say, that's how the story goes for his life and career. Just always so close, yet unfortunately it gets pulled away from him.
Yeah. So yeah, that year was their final season, and that would end that. They would end the Rochester Jeffersons as a team.
Was the last official season the 1925 season?
Yes. Yep.
And what did he do after they shut business?
All right. So after that ends, he still loves football. He still loves the league. He becomes, through different NFL functions, becomes a good friend of George Halas. Somewhere along the line, George Halas offers Leo a job on the Bears. However, Leo turns him down because Leo is now like bitter. Like, I guess he felt like George was like an equal to him and he didn't want to work for him. I don't know. There's a lot of stories of, you know, why he didn't take him up on the offer. He probably should have, obviously, but I don't know if it was pride or what it was, but he turned him down for a job on the Bears.
After he turned him down for that job, where did he go next?
Well, he started a professional paint company, a brush paint and brush company called the Lions Paint Company here in Rochester. That ends up becoming a huge paint business here in Rochester. And at the same time, of course, he can't just do one thing. He's got to do like several things at once. So at that time, he also starts a bowling league with all the teams from New York State. And there's Leo on the cover of the sports section in 1930. Leo wins the state championship for Rochester. It's like, what? And then there's newspaper articles, Leo and Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe is traveling the country for Indians abuse, the country abusing Indians. And Leo invites him to Rochester. Leo has Jim Thorpe tour the Rochester City schools, talking to the children. Leo's with him. Just a lot of things like that through the 30s, 40s, and 50s. He does a lot of charity work. During World War II, he was in the front sports section for starting up all kinds of charities. He was trying to get the NFL to play exhibition games here to support the war. Again, he, for whatever reason, like going at newspapers.com, if you Google Leo Lyons, I mean, thousands of news articles. It's incredible. I can't believe, you know, after football, I was like, okay, you know, he's done. But no, he was constantly doing something. So during this time, he's also collecting football memorabilia because the early years of the NFL, a lot of people didn't think it was going to, you know, continue. So yeah, he would collect a lot of that stuff and keep it in his downstairs, which slowly his downstairs was becoming a miniature Hall of Fame. So come 1960, he becomes friends with Pete Rozelle, NFL commissioner at the time, tells him, you know, Cooperstown has got baseball Hall of Fame since the 1930s, really time for a Hall of Fame for football. So that had taken place. They were talking about doing it. It's finally agreed upon that they're going to do it in Canton, Ohio. And that day in 1963, when the Hall of Fame opens, Leo's on stage. Leo's there for the ribbon cutting ceremony. Leo's on the field for the coin toss. Did a huge thing for the opening of the Hall of Fame itself.
Yeah, I had no idea that he was part of, you know, helping initiate the Hall of Fame as well as, you know, working through it. And a lot of stuff that he was involved in, even thereafter the early years, it sounds like.
Yeah, and what was nice was George Halas, during his induction speech in 1963, as one of the original, you know, men to be put in the Hall of Fame, George Halas would say it was men like Leo Lyons who started this league who really don't get the credit for giving it their all. You know, it's like, I'm so glad he did that. That was a big nod to him publicly. Leo had done all that and nobody knows who he is.
Right. Yeah. I had never even heard of him until I started researching, you know, the Jeffs. I found your website and then reading through, I was like, man, this is an incredible story. And every time you keep bringing more up, I'm like, wow, I'm took back by it.
So yeah, so then we got the opening of the Hall of Fame. And then Leo, through the years, is always invited to the owners' meetings around the country. Now, like, that's unusual for some kid who had six seasons in the NFL. Invited to every owner's meeting.
Right. Yeah. That is unique,
which is very unique. And that's where he would become also good friends with Art Rooney and Vince Lombardi, which I don't know if he wasn't an owner, but Vince Lombardi was also at these owner's meetings a lot. And then in the late 60s, NFL owners unanimously agreed to make Leo Lyons the honorary historian of the league. That was bestowed upon him in Los Angeles. I think it was 67 or 68. So that was really neat.
Huh.
So yeah, just very involved with those guys. And they would remain lifelong friends. I mean, Jim Thorpe, Art Rooney, George Halas. You know, that's why I talked to a lot of people. I'm like, there's got to be something more. When I first was researching this, I'm like, why would these big guys, successful men, remain lifelong friends with a guy who had a team for six seasons?
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, that's, yeah, there's got to be more there, in which obviously there was going through this interview. And do you remember any specific stories that he told you as a young lad, or were you too young to really remember any of those?
No, I remember them. It's actually a pretty, again, story within a story within a story. We'll go back to the birth date, his birthday. He was born on March 11th. When my mother was expecting, and I was supposed to be born March 2nd, I think, was my due date, her due date. And during that time, Leo was very close to my mom, and which would have been his granddaughter, and always joked, he's going to be born on my birthday. and it was a running joke for a week and a half. And sure enough, March 11th rolled around and she has me.
Wow.
So we end up with the same birthday. So, as growing up as a baby, he was always very fond of me. There weren't a lot of boys around. And when we would go over to their house, he would hold me as a baby. And I have in my possession, the 1916 New York State Championship trophy, which is a shiny football trophy. Which was actually the next year. That 16 state championship led to him trash talking Jim Thorpe. So I hold that trophy very dear to me because that was a key cog in his plan. So rolling backwards here, when I was a little baby, my mom said that he would always show me that football trophy and I'd always be touching it because it was so shiny. And I go, what irony is that when I was a baby, you know, I was drawn to this football and now present day, it's actually at this museum right now, Strom Museum, being displayed in Rochester.
Wow. Yeah. That's such a cool artifact to be able to have too.
Right. I mean, as well as that, I have a 1923 NFL franchise certificate signed by the first commissioner of the NFL. I mean, that's extremely rare, as I've found out now. I have a uniform, the actual cleats, pants, helmet from Leo, I believe, from 1921. And, a lot of hundreds of photos, a football. I forgot the football. I have a 1921 game ball from the Rochester Jeffersons versus Chicago Bears. First game the Bears played at Wrigley Field, and I have that ball.
Yeah, that's got to be another one of those just national treasure type moment kind of situations.
Yeah, it's torn in a spot, which is actually neat because you can see the inside. It's actually a pig bladder. It has no air hole. Back then, it was a pig bladder stuffed with sawdust. That was your football.
Huh.
And it actually has the original Wilson insignia with a big W, and it says Thomas A. Wilson across in a square box. They only used that for the early 1920s, and luckily the logo is still on the ball. I don't believe that there are any NFL game balls anywhere, I don't believe, in existence still.
Yeah, I mean, almost 100 years, and that brings us to now and here, 2019. We're in the middle of the 100th season of the NFL, all starting back in that Hupmobile Auto Showroom. And
yep.
Great-granddaddy was part of it all at the beginning.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I went this year to Canton to see what they have done. I hadn't been there in 15 years, so I wanted to see what they had at the Hall of Fame. And they were extremely nice. They didn't let me pay admission. They brought me in. They let me have privy to all of Leo's files, which included like telegrams through the years, more photos that I didn't have that had ever seen. And then I met with the president of the Hall of Fame, David Baker, who I went to his office and we discussed their plans for a Founders Exhibit, which should be on display for the 2020 season. And there's also a park in development, which will be a state-of-the-art park with like a dome on it, a large screen TV. There's going to be all kinds of like these structures with all NFL owners and players throughout history. And Leo would be on the first structure with the beginning of the NFL. So that was exciting to learn that they're going to be honoring the men that started the league.
Yeah, I'm glad that they're doing that as well, too. I mean, going through this show, of course, that's a lot of stuff I've learned. I had no clue. And it's neat to think that a bunch of people had a dream and then they just had the grit and tenacity to be able to put it together and actually go forward. And then now here we take it for granted 100 years later, but it all started back then. That was the base. And people like your great granddaddy who he's bootlegging, he's working three jobs and he has no backing, but he didn't care because that was his passion. He really cared for the team and he really wanted to make it successful.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing that I'm doing all this now is that nobody here in Rochester knows the name Leo Lyons, nor do they know that the Roger Jeffersons were an original NFL team. It's like, to me, if I was Leo, I would be really, really saddened that, you know, 100 years later, I've been forgotten. My team's been forgotten. I think that's a shame. So that's why I'm doing all this now, working on a book, the website, Facebook, and then the museum here in Rochester, the Strong Museum, which had 500,000 visitors last year, worked with the Buffalo Bills this year, and they're doing a then and now exhibit, 100 years of the NFL. I've loaned them the uniform and football, and the Buffalo Bills have loaned a current uniform and football and memorabilia. So it makes me happy to see people learning again that we had an NFL team.
Again, to me, that's why this episode is more interesting than a Chicago Bear. Everybody does Chicago Bears episodes, but who's actually been able to listen to Leo Lyons' story? Not too many.
Well, that's what, yeah. I mean, even the president of the Hall of Fame, he's like, he goes, I give you kudos. You're someone who's unique because, you know, here you are. There's a team that only lasted six seasons, but you have, you know, all the team photos. You have memorabilia from the team. I mean, nobody else has any. I mean, a franchise certificate from the team.
I mean, no right? One, yeah, that's sweet.
I don't even think any of like the Bears. I don't think anyone saved them from the 20s. You know, it's like that's what makes me unique. You know, I've already had people offer me money. Like somebody found out that I had the football. I was on a telecast with the Buffalo Bills on MSG Network, and somebody saw the football. They freaking contacted me the next day. He goes, I'm in Houston, Texas right now. He goes, I will fly up right now if you'll sell me that football. I go, how much are we talking? He's like, a lot of money. I go, to be honest with you, no, I can't sell it because that gives me clout. That gives me something. If I lose my memorabilia, you know, it's like, that's part of my stuff. That's my thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's family too. Another thing is just so cool. The stories that you're able to tell of, like you said, with Vince Lombardi and Halas and Rooney and being in your great grandpa's kitchen. And at the time, not knowing even who they were, but just looking right back at it.
Right. I remember them smoking cigars and people at meetings, I've told them that they're like, tell us that story about the guys that hung around Leo's house. And I'll be like, oh yeah, Vince Lombardi, Art Rooney. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah. I go, isn't that crazy? And then at that time, I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Right, yeah.
Now I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? And then there's so many more stories. I mean, I didn't even tell you, like, you know, the wedding. The two of them, Leo got married to his wife. The two families didn't get along, so they got married at a church the next day. And only people in attendance were the Rochester Jefferson football team and Walter Hagen, the famous golfer. they were the only two in the wedding in the chapel.
Really?
I mean, talk about like making a movie, or you know, you could see it in a movie. You know, it's like the so many crazy stories, and there's a bunch more. It's like I could just go on and on. But
one thing I want to ask you before we kind of start wrapping up here is, each guest I give them the question of this. I say, I'm going to give you the keys to my DeLorean, and you can go back in time any point in history so you can be present for one moment. Where would you go?
Oh, that's a good one. I like that. Wow, with Leo, it's really tough to pick one. Well, I would have to go to the Hupmobile car showroom in September 17, 1920, when they started the NFL, to see Leo standing there with those other great men around the around those cars starting the NFL. That would be quite a scene to see. So yeah, we'll go with September 17th, 1920.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And as we wrap up, is there anywhere else you'd like to have the fans of the show come and check out some of your work?
Basically, yeah, the website, the RogerJeffersons.org. I'm still putting on more things. I've actually got a lot more pictures and things that I just got at the Hall of Fame while I was there. So I'm going to be updating that. So there's a lot of information, a lot of pictures, a lot of neat pictures on there of team photos, and there's some game photos of the Jeffersons playing the New York Giants at the Polo Grounds and neat shots like that.
All right. Well, we'll again leave links to that in the show notes. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This is a great honor to be able to, like you say, get the word out. And I'm so happy that people like you, you know, are interested in the history of football, because there is a lot of things that are interesting, and it's sad to see them be lost in time. And I'm glad that you're bringing them back out.
Well, there you go. The team, the man that you probably never heard of, but they both had a profound impact on the history of the NFL. And they were at the beginning, the foundation, and they were one of the original 14 NFL teams. Now, I originally set out to create this episode about the Rochester Jeffersons, and then I found this website. It was RochesterJeffersons.org. I found out that John Steffenhagen was Leo Lyon's great-grandson, and then through this interview, I realized that Leo Lyon should have changed himself to Leo Legends. Now, this was a true one-man wrecking crew. And I hope you enjoyed the legendary knowledge nuggets that John shared with us. And again, you can find out more about John, Leo, and the Rochester Jeffersons on the dedicated page on my site, which you can get to by going to thefootballhistorydude.com/John Steffenhagen. That's John, J-O-H-N, Steffenhagen, 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 John Steffenhagen. Again, I want to just give John a big thank you for stopping by and riding shotgun on this DeLorean with us and sharing with us the hidden story of the NFL that is the Rochester Jeffersons, but to me, even more niche down, Leo Lyons, Leo Legends. This was an incredible story that Hollywood could not create, that I think they need to make a movie about. But that's not for me to decide. Now, if you thought this was an intriguing story yourself and you would like to see it into a movie, perhaps, then why don't you go ahead and share it with at least one football geek such as yourself. Then, of course, also make sure that they mash that little subscribe button on their podcast player choice. That way, they get the hottest, freshest out the press episodes each and every week. But speaking of next week, we're going to keep this ball rolling down the field with discussions about the original 14 NFL teams. This time, we're going to learn about a team called the Hammond Pros. But for now, dudes, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.